So hello and welcome to our session on Are Mormons Christian? My name is Lorian Dunlop and I'll be your moderator for this session. I wanted to quickly give you some of my own personal perspectives on the topic. I was raised Assembly of God. I'm not a Mormon, for full disclosure, but I'm related to lots of them. So. I've been hanging out in the Bloggernacle since post-Prop 8 and learned a lot and made a lot of friends. But I was raised in the Assembly of God, which, if you know anything about it, it's a Pentecostal fundamentalist sect. And I remember growing up that we had really strong opinions about who was a Christian and who was not a Christian. We knew for a fact that the Catholics weren't, because they, you know, worship statues. And we knew that was not okay. And we also were pretty sure that the Lutherans and the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians, especially Episcopalians, ooh, bad stuff, and the, you know, Methodists, they were not going to heaven because, you know, they didn't really believe in their hearts. They just recited prayers. And, you know, God doesn't like that sort of thing. So we were pretty sure that the Four Square Gospel people were okay. They believed pretty much like us. I mean, they had Amy Semple McPherson and the whole motorcycle thing, but she was in their distant past, and they'd come around since then, you know, clean up their act. And then there were the Baptists. Now, the Baptists are a real conundrum because, you know, they don't believe in speaking in tongues, and so that's kind of blasphemy against the Holy Spirit in Assembly of God terms. And so were they going to heaven? Were they not? I don't know. They were saved, but they weren't filled with the Spirit. So we had some very, very rigid views about who was a Christian and who was not. And then when I started to experience myself as a lesbian woman and figure out who I was through my teens and into my 20s, I was presented with a real conundrum because I was, you know, at the two furthest extreme poles, you know, could you be gay and Christian? And so I spent a lot of time learning and researching, and in the course of that, I became an Episcopalian. And I learned a great deal from the Episcopalians about church history, and real church history, not what I had been taught in my church growing up. And about all the schisms and everything that went into defining Christianity as an identity. And I came to the conclusion that, yes, it was very possible to be both gay and Christian, and that the older I got, the more certain I became that Christianity does not mean what you think it means, to quote The Princess Bride, which we watched last night. But it's actually an identity that's really based most rigorously in, do I follow what I think Christ taught? Do I try to imitate Christ? Do I try to be who I think Christ would be in the world? And I think that that's true of a great deal many more people than actually either apply the word Christian to themselves or have it applied to them by others. And so I've reached a point in my life where Christianity is a very broad thing, and I don't really like the idea of pigeonholing and saying who is or is not a Christian. I think it's a self-determined label, and probably not even a really necessary one. So all of that to say, I think we have a wonderful distinguished panel here. Let me just tell you a bit about them. First up will be Lori Winder Stromberg, who I understand is an absolute matriarch within the theological community here. She was the managing editor of the Journal of Modern History, an editor of the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly, associate editor of Sunstone, and the co-founder and chair of the Sunstone West Symposium, and she served on the board of Exponent 2 and presently serves on the executive board of Ordained Women. I'm impressed. And then after her, we will have Jana Reese, who has a PhD in American Religious History from Columbia University. She is the author or co-author or editor of many books, including Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. What Would Buffy Do, the Vampire Slayer, as a Spiritual Guide? I like that. And Mormonism for Dummies. And then after that, we will hear from Dan Weatherspoon. Weatherspoon? Did I say it right? Thank you. Who is a freelance writer and editor and host of Mormon Matters podcast. And he led Sunstone from 2001 to 2008, so I'm assuming you're all very familiar with him. He has a master's and doctorate in religion with an undergraduate major in philosophy. And then we have Sarah Burlingame. And did I say that right? Did I say your name right? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm terrible with names, so I apologize. Who is a faith organizer for the Human Rights Campaign. She's a Unitarian Universalist who was raised as a Baha'i in the Intermountain West. She writes and speaks nationally about interfaith dialogue between Mormons and others. She makes her home in Cheyenne, Wyoming, with a funny, kind man and her three rowdy boys. So I would like to introduce Lori Winder-Stromberg.
I'm not sure. I think some people set it down.
I mean, there's a recorder right in front of you. It helps.
Okay. So I guess I could put it around my neck. Is that okay?
Sure.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
Good. Are Mormons Christian? Despite certain remarks after the church's press conference this week, I would say insistently so, at least since 1982, if the blog askgramps.org can be considered authoritative. That's when the subtitle, Another Testament of Jesus Christ, was added to the Book of Mormon. A few years later, President Ezra Taft Benson explained that it was added to aid in focusing the efforts of the church to more fully utilize the Book of Mormon in general, and specifically to testify of Christ. This would signal, particularly in the decades that followed, movement in our public discourse away from some of our more distinctive controversial doctrines. For example, many of us were a bit stunned when President Gordon B. Hinckley seemed to step away from one such doctrine. In 1997, Don Lattin, a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, asked, quote, there are significant differences in your beliefs. For instance, don't Mormons believe that God was once a man? Unquote. President Hinckley responded, quote, I wouldn't say that. There was a little couplet coined, as man is, God once was, as God is, man may become. Now, that's just more of a couplet than anything else. That gets into some pretty deep theology, and we don't know very much about that. That's from April 13, 1997. I think this backing away signifies an effort to appeal to mainstream Christians, and until yesterday, not to alienate potential Romney voters. That we might be gradually succeeding in claiming a spot among other Christians is evidenced by the title of a recent review in Christianity Today by Paul Lewis Metzger, professor of theology and culture at Multnomah Biblical Seminary. Are Mormons more Christian than we think? The review considers the book Mormon Christianity by Stephen H. Webb. According to the review, and I'll be quoting extensively from this, Webb, a formerly evangelical, now Roman Catholic scholar, advances an ongoing dialogue between historic Christianity and Mormonism, which has been building momentum for several years. Three other volumes, including involving scholars with a connection to evangelicalism, also stand out. How Wide the Divide, a Mormon and an Evangelical in Conversation by Bloomberg and Robinson, which came out in 1997, Claiming Christ, a Mormon Evangelical Debate by Millett and McDermott in 2007, and Talking with Mormons, an Invitation to Evangelicals by Mao in 2012. Obviously, foundational to the question, are Mormons Christian, are the further questions, what do you mean by Christian, and what do you mean by Mormon? Sometimes it's hard to tease these out for both traditions. Mormonism doesn't have a systematic theology, and Christian doctrine has been in flux and contested since its origins. Further complicating the question for this panel is the fact that though Mormons share the language of traditional Christianity, we often mean radically different things. This is why Mormons are left scratching their heads and wondering why many Christians question our claim on Christianity. Sterling Murin writes, this is in his foreword to The Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion, "The most interesting thing about Mormon theology is that it incorporates a liberal doctrine of man, I would add in women, and a radically unorthodox concept of God within the general framework of historic Christian fundamentalism. This has far-reaching implications, for while it strengthens the naturalistic and pragmatic propensities of the Mormon people without weakening their ties to Christian origins, it must inevitably produce fundamental tensions in the intellectual life of the church. The distinctive character of Mormon theology resides especially in the finitistic concept of God and the denial of the traditional doctrines of original sin and salvation by grace," which we could probably argue about. How many here have actually read the church's statement on LDS.org? Okay. Well, basically, and feel free to jump in, anybody, if I'm not going to restate it in its entirety, but basically it affirms that Mormons are unequivocally Christian and then addresses three of the most prominent reasons given for denying Mormons that claim. First, and I'm quoting from it, "Latter-day Saints do not accept the creeds, confessions, and formulations of post-New Testament Christianity." And I emphasize post. "Two, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not descend through the historical line of traditional Christianity. That is, Latter-day Saints are not Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, or Protestant." And, of course, that's important in terms of line of authority. "Three, Latter-day Saints do not believe Scripture consists of the Holy Bible alone, but have an expanded canon of Scripture that includes the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine of Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price." Dealing with the first, i.e., Latter-day Saints do not accept the creeds, confessions, and formulations of post-New Testament Christianity, the first is true-ish. Latter-day Saints do not accept the creeds, confessions, and formulations of post-New Testament Christianity, although we borrow liberally from over 2,000 years of Christian thought. Most notably, many assert, the Pelagian and Arminian heresies. And technically, those who deny us Christian status would probably claim we don't accept New Testament Christianity either. Despite that assertion, Latter-day Saints, the LDS.org statement affirms, quote, "believe in a restored Christianity. We are restorationists in both our claims to belief and authority. In fact, one of the arguments made by Church Public Affairs to deny women priesthood in response to recent calls for female ordination," which ordination I support, "is the claim that we follow the pattern set by Jesus himself. The problem is we have no biblical record of Jesus ordaining Gentiles, or for that matter, 12-year-olds. There are biblical texts, however, that refer to women deacons and apostles, particularly in Romans 16 in the New Revised Standard Version. In fact, the earliest Christian communities met in homes where women wielded a great deal of power. Indeed, according to Claremont Patristics historian Karen Torgeson, women led congregations. It was only when Christianity left the domestic sphere and entered the public sphere, which at that time was by definition and tradition male, that Christian women lost ecclesiastical power. But I digress. In addition to being restorationists, Mormons are also rabid materialists. This is what the Christianity Today review focuses on. It's what drives many Christians crazy, but intrigues others, including Webb, Stephen Webb, the author of the book reviewed. Webb's thesis, I'm going to quote from this without constantly saying quote-unquote, okay? quoting from the review, Webb's thesis is that Mormons have an original, fascinating, and provocative metaphysics. What is so provocative and appealing about Mormon metaphysics? It is the notion of God's eternal material embodiment. As Webb writes near the outset of the volume, much of this book is nothing more than an attempt to take seriously the possibility that God has a form or shape that is something like what we call a body. For Webb, this perspective bears on the whole range of Mormon thought and practice. For Metzger, Mormon metaphysics is challenging in that it flies in the face of traditional Christian teaching, which rejects the notion that God is embodied. According to historic Christianity, God is pure immaterial spirit by nature. For the Latter-day Saints, according to Metzger, matter is the very stuff of the divine. Mormonism holds to a metaphysic wherein all reality, including spirit, is material, including God and the soul. Another significant point of contention between Mormonism and traditional Christianity is the fact that Mormonism denies creation ex nihilo. Sternly McMurrin suggests that, quote, this denial supports Mormonism's finitistic theology and its radically unorthodox doctrine of man and woman. Mormons are careful not to use all of the omnis when describing God. Would that be your experience? We use omniscient and omnipotent, yes, but because we're radical materialists, we're a little fuzzy on omnipresent. Okay? But should we use any of them is the question. This is a potent example of using the language of traditional Christianity, but meaning something radically different. The problem is, as my question suggests, is that using a less than apt vocabulary can actually muddy or alter belief. The way we say things can actually affect the way we think about them. And that's one of the problems that we have in even dealing with that, using the language of traditional Christianity. But as McMurrin's book also points out, Mormon theology has its foundations, as I said before, in 2,000 years of Christian thought, as heretical, radical, or conventional as it might be. McMurrin reminds us, among the ideas that importantly characterize Mormon theology, I find nothing that is exclusive to it. So is that might be an interesting thing to talk about. I mean, unless everybody pretty much agrees on that. So let me end by punctuating that the LDS doctrine of God's finitism, says McMurrin, involves process. And we're part of that process. So in that sort of statement, I mean that sort of encapsulates a lot of the problem that traditional Christians have with Mormons. Okay, and let me just read McMurrin again. God is placed not above or without, but within the ongoing processes of the universe. The ultimate immutability of reality is thereby denied, and world history, human effort, human achievement, and human freedom take on a new meaning. For the future is real and unique, not merely from the perspective of men and women, but as well from the perspective of God. It's a radical theology. Ladies, no. Thank you. You may wish I were done, but I have another paragraph. As a Mormon feminist activist, I don't want to let go of our distinctive doctrines, some of our distinctive doctrines, like this one, in order to appease mainstream Christians, particularly those that support what I call moral activism. Because in Mormonism, our essential selves are uncreated, our choices have real and profound theological consequence. We are not creatures, but co-creators with God, not only as parents, but as moral agents, striving with God for a more just and equitable world. We are not mere instruments in God's hands, but co-actors with God. President Chieko Okazaki, a former member of the Relief Society General Presidency, wrote, quotes, "In most Mormon gatherings, if I were to ask you who you are, particularly what your eternal identity is, many would answer, 'I'm a child of God.' It is a beautiful answer shaped by the primary song we have learned and loved for two generations. But that is not enough. Every living person is a child of God, but that's not the ending point. The ending point is to become peers of God, friends of God, co-workers of God, adults of God. As such, we are radically," unquote. "As such, we are radically responsible for our choice either to perpetuate injustice by silence and inaction or to embrace a moral activism, a Mormon activism, a Christian activism that requires us to work for goodness, justice, and equality."
So as I was thinking about this, I was reflecting on Doctrine and Covenants section 49, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think is the first recorded example of Mormon interfaith dialogue with a religious group. So this is when Sidney Rigdon is sent to the Shakers to sort of persuade them to our correct point of view. And it reminds me how we test ourselves out. We define ourselves sort of in opposition to others. Mormonism was prompted here to clarify its own doctrines regarding meat, which was okay, a female deity, not okay, and celibacy, which is also totally not okay for Mormonism. But see how we define ourselves in opposition to another religious group. I'm going to go through the three parts of this document. Don't get worried that the first part is the longest. It is the longest. Part three is hardly anything, so just bear with me, and don't be worried. And this is a bit of history, so please bear with me with that as well. Part one, if you recall, was Latter-day Saints do not accept the creeds of post-New Testament Christianity. So I want to unpack what that means. We are arguing that the merging of Christianity with Greek philosophy was a grave error. So what it says here in the statement is, Latter-day Saints believe the melding of early Christian theology with Greek philosophy was a grave error. That is a direct quote. But we're also saying that this is something that happened after the second century. And this is not the case. There was already very significant Hellenistic influence from more than 300 years before Christ, exemplified in many places in the biblical witness, from the struggles of the Maccabees to retain their Jewish culture in the face of encroaching Greek culture, even to the concept of the Logos in the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word. This is a Greek idea right in the New Testament. By the way, speaking of the New Testament, what language is it written in? Greek, right. So to say that this Greek influence happens later is really not a historically tenable view. When Paul set off on his missionary travels, he did not have to go to the MTC first to learn Greek. All of the people in the Mediterranean world that he would be preaching to, no matter what culture they were from, Greek was the lingua franca. It had affected everyone in their world. So we could stop in this statement, stop dissing Greek influence as something very new and something very bad. It was much older, and the record on it is mixed. Now, there's an idea that's crucial to this whole document, this concept of restoration, that somewhere back there, there's this purity. If we could just get back there to this halcyon time before all the accretions set into Christianity, then everything would be awesome. But the New Testament itself is so much more complex than that view of a New Testament purity. For example, if we are serious in our rejection of anything additional, any accretion that occurred in Christianity in the second century and beyond, we also have to reject the canon of the New Testament itself. That was a decision made by committee. The very kind of committee that this statement suggests is, quote, post-New Testament Christianity, unquote. The statement itself begins from a false premise, which is that the New Testament was already finished by the time the so-called apostasy was supposed to have occurred. The New Testament canon was not fixed until the end of the 4th century. And when you think about it, that makes sense, because Christianity did not become a state religion of the Roman Empire until the 4th century. And before that, Christianity in practice, like she's already mentioned, very much house churches, local communities, very grassroots. You might, in your little community, you might have two Gospels. Maybe you've collected three letters of Paul, and maybe you have one additional post-Pauline document, like Hebrews. But over here, what they have is a couple other letters of Paul and maybe one Gospel that doesn't correspond with what you have. All of that did not become centralized in any way until the Roman Empire began to do it in the 4th century. So our gospel topic statement speaks of religions like Catholicism that base some of their decision-making on post-New Testament church councils and creeds. But the irony here is that we would not even have the New Testament if it were not for those same councils. Let's have a little appreciation, you know? It's not quite fair to draw this sharp distinction between our New Testament Christianity and other Christians' post-New Testament Christianity. I just want to say we are all swimming in the same 4th century soup. If we were really serious about keeping the tenets of 1st century Christianity, the Christianity that we think of as the Halcyon time, the Apostolic Age, we would be listening to another book, which is called the Didache. Has anyone here ever heard of the Didache? One person? Yeah? Couple people. Okay. All right. So this is a 1st century text, possibly early 2nd century, but contemporaneous with much of the New Testament. And it is billed as the 1st century teachings of the apostles. It's the first book that we have in the historical record that shows what Christians did in their daily lives. How did they worship? How did they practice? How did they baptize people? So we know from this, for example, that they prayed between 5 and 7 times a day at prescribed times, facing the direction of the Jerusalem temple. And if you look carefully in the New Testament, you can actually see that the apostles did this too. The first healing in the book of Acts that takes place in the 3rd chapter of Acts happens on the steps of the temple, and Peter and his companion are there observing fixed hour prayer in the temple. And the text goes out of its way to tell us that it was 3 o'clock, which is one of the 7 times during the day, or 6 times in the Roman world, when you would do that. Also on the rooftop, when Peter has that totally funky vision of the pigs, and suddenly pigs are clean, and they're kosher, and they're awesome, that happens at 12 o'clock. He's praying on the rooftop so he can face the temple in Jerusalem. This was fixed hour prayer. So this was something that we know the apostles did. We don't do that. We don't talk about that. So really, what kind of leg do we have to stand on to say that there is this direct restoration, this uninterrupted continuation of New Testament Christianity and what we do? Other things that are advocated in the Didache, which would not be very popular, include fasting from food on both Wednesday and Friday, fasting before a baptism, which I can just imagine would be very popular with every 8-year-old you know, and then reciting the Lord's Prayer 3 times a day. That was something that early Christians did that we do not do. I bring this up just to say a little humility would be great. Every time we want to see ourselves as the sole heirs to this true historic Christian tradition in all of its fullness, let's think of the truths that the apostles were living that we don't live. Part 2. Latter-day Saints believe in a restored Christianity. Now, this part opens with a statement I agree with wholeheartedly, which is, quote, "Members of creedal churches often mistakenly assume that all Christians have always agreed and must agree on a historically static, monolithic collection of beliefs. As many scholars have acknowledged, however, Christians have vigorously disagreed about virtually every issue of theology and practice through the centuries, leading to the creation of a multitude of Christian denominations," unquote. So I agree with that. What's wrong with that statement, though? Anybody? So our tradition, do we never disagree? We have a totally awesome relationship with our theology and history. There's nothing messy about it. Right, okay. We are guilty of exactly the same thing that we are accusing other groups of doing.
Everything else is policy, though. Not
oh, there you go. Everything else is policy.
But we'll nod to what's happening across
okay.
the race.
The implication here is that Mormonism, by contrast, has always been unified in its beliefs, and that Mormonism, again, is a direct continuation, uninterrupted, of biblical Christianity. I wanted to briefly tell a story of when I was investigating the church in my early 20s, and some friends took me to an LDS visitor center at the temple in Washington, D.C. And I don't remember the details, but there was some kind of diorama or display that had Solomon's temple. And there was a missionary there, a young woman, who was very enthusiastically telling us, Solomon had a temple. We have a temple. Therefore, you know, you see where this is going, right? Right. And I didn't say anything, because I'm actually a much nicer person in person than I am about things like this. But here's what I would have said if I'd had the guts. Your Mormon temple is awfully large compared to the roughly 2,000 square feet of Solomon's temple. Good for you. You Mormons must be so successful. Everything is bigger in America. But you know, seeing that, it makes me wonder something. What kinds of animals do you sacrifice in your temple? And what do you do with all that blood? What? You have wall-to-wall carpet in your temple? How does that work with all the blood? Also, I'm seeing women in your temples, and they seem to go everywhere. I mean, do you have women who go into the Holy of Holies? You don't have a Holy of Holies? What about on Yom Kippur? You don't do Yom Kippur? What? Okay, my mind is totally blown here, but... So you're saying that people come to this one centralized temple from all over the world, right? No. You're saying you have more than 100 temples around the world? You have how many temples? The book of 1 Kings is totally clear that Hashem only wants the one house to dwell in. And you guys are the ones who insist that Hashem has a body? Okay, well, I'm going to work with having however many temples, but you know that does raise an issue that's important, which is where did you get all of the slaves to build all of your temples? I mean, the Bible says that Solomon had thousands of slaves working on just this one small temple, and here you're telling me you've got dozens and dozens all over the world. Okay, you get the point. There is no direct historical connection between Solomon and the purpose of Solomon's temple and the purposes of our temples today. But we do this all the time. We take one thing from the Bible, we take it completely out of context, and we point up to it and we say, look at that! That's us! 3,000 years ago. Part three. This is the short part. Latter-day Saints believe in an open canon. Again, this is a very good statement to claim that the Bible is the sole and final word of God. More specifically, the final written word of God is to claim more for the Bible than the Bible claims for itself. I think that that is true. But the statement goes on to say, moreover, not all Christian churches are certain that Christianity must be defined by commitment to a closed canon. In truth, the argument for exclusion by closed canon appears to be used selectively to exclude the Latter-day Saints from being called Christian. No branch of Christianity limits itself entirely to the biblical text in making doctrinal decisions and in applying biblical principles. I read this and I thought, what, really? We are so egotistical that we imagine that other religions are manipulating their doctrine and history just to exclude us? It doesn't make sense. But that is how self-centered our tradition is. We're small. We're fairly adolescent. You know, as some final thoughts, we are Christian. Why don't we focus on what the statement needs to say about what it means to follow Jesus? Or acknowledging that our church's theology and history are every bit as messy and dynamic as the church's this statement appears to be criticizing. I want to close by acknowledging that today is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Thomas Merton. If he had not been electrocuted and he'd lived a long time, he would be 100 years old today. But he was killed in 1968. He died in Thailand when he was there on a trip for a conference of intermonastic dialogue between Catholic monks and Buddhist monks. And about an hour before he died, he said these words, I believe that by openness to Buddhism, to Hinduism, and to the great Asian traditions, we stand a wonderful chance of learning more about the potentiality of our own traditions, because they have gone from the natural point of view so much deeper into this than we have. What I like about this statement is its openness and its humility. Thomas Merton was a deeply committed Catholic. He believed his religion was the right one, but he never stopped recognizing or searching for the truth that other people also had. And if you look at the concluding thoughts on the Are Mormons Christian statement, it closes with this line, "The Christian conversation is richer for what the Latter-day Saints bring to the table." Yes, that's true. But there's nothing in this document about what everybody else brings to the table, except when we're trying to criticize it. There's no sense of being teachable. There's no sense of learning, of listening deeply to what these traditions are trying to say. I think that as Mormons, we are asking the wrong question. First and foremost, the question should not be, are Mormons Christian? That reflects an immaturity on our part, an adolescent preoccupation with finding ourselves in other people's eyes. The better question would be the one that Merton is asking. What can we learn from other traditions that can help us to maximize the potential of our own? Thank you.
I think my remarks will feel quite different from these. Not that I disagree. I'm so glad just to have such diverse approaches to this. A little bit of what Jana said at the end about what's missing in terms of a positive message is really where I'll be mostly focusing. I'm going to do two things right up front that will make a little more sense later. One thing that's missing from my bio is I'm a San Diegan. It was always Grandma and Grandpa's house, so from Sacramento we would always come down here and spend a lot of time during the summer. But then from age 11 to age 20, I would have considered San Diego home in Chula Vista, California. And the reason I'm bringing this up here now is when you live here, I'm guessing this is an example or something that everybody else could relate to too, you always know where the ocean is. You know, wherever you are, you know, your life is sort of oriented around that. I'm in Utah now, so the Wasatch Mountains kind of serve a little bit, you know, to always know whether you're going north, south, or something like that. But the ocean, for me, it was just a powerful presence. I mean, it would be where I went when I ditched school. You know, it was just a presence in my life early on, certainly one of my career paths. Well, first of all, the one I was going to be was a Shamu, the whale trainer. You know, because I'm Mr. Show-Off and I get to do all that stuff. But I definitely, you know, marine biology and things like that. And just the ocean is a powerful present for me. And later in my life, it's become more of a metaphor for me about kind of always knowing where spirit is. Sort of kind of working my spiritual journey to such a point that I kind of feel something in my life always there, and it waxes and it wanes, but like the ocean, I kind of always know where it is, and I know where I could go to find it, and when I'm a little bit away from it, I know I can return to it, and so I just wanted to kind of put that out as a metaphor at first here, and the second one is I'm kind of known in this Mormon podcasting, you know, online presence as somebody who's upbeat, you know, who generally will, you know, think the best of our tradition, will always try to complicate a super negative narrative. I don't know. I think it came from just 20 years of wrestling and, you know, and knowing that there's no simple narrative that captures it all and things like this. But I think it's also a personality trait. I'm not super impulsive. You know, I'm not... you know, I must act exactly this way right now. I've never been that. You know, I'm that way. But I'll let you know. I mean, I just need to admit that this time that we're living in right now, I'm down. You know, I felt Tuesday's press conference as a disappointment. You know, just another example of how far our tradition has to go to really be prophetic, to really be who it could be, to really be an adult, you know, live the adolescent stuff and trying to see. That was a great metaphor there. So I'm a bit down. I'm a bit down with what's happening with John DeLynn. You know, I attended the one on peace and violence, and I would just love what Joanna Brooks was calling for. This is like, excommunication is off the table. You know, this is not even something that we consider. We just don't other people. You know, we don't take somebody and we say, you're not what, us, and things like this. And so I'm down right now. And then reading this essay, it did not help. Revisiting this particular one, it was just so disappointing to me that it's, as Jana, I think, was mostly pointing out more than Lori, this is defense. You know, let's let other people throw the categories at us, to say the things that we are and we aren't, and we're just defending them. And there's nothing in here that is a sort of a positive statement of why we're Christian and why you should just notice that we're Christian because of the transformed lives that we have or something like that because of this message of God and things like this. So I just wanted to say, I'm disappointed, and I got to just, tying it to my San Diego and the ocean thing, Jackson Brown, Rock Me on the Water, Sisters of the Sun, you know? I got to get down to the sea somehow, ease my fevered brow. That's what I want, and that's what I want to kind of share today a little bit about. Our call, at least in the... This is the greatest... Is this you, Stephen?
It was Lindsay's idea.
Oh, you guys catch what he's got going here. This is, you know, the old style pamphleting and stuff like that. It's just really gorgeous. But how the new gospel topic essays are shaping modern Mormonism. And in this case, the first thing that came to me is... You know, I could say very badly, but basically, it's a missed chance to shape modern Mormonism. This was a complete swing and a miss for me. There was guess what? The word atonement is not in this document. You know, there's one line in here that kind of goes at least to where I want to talk just for a few minutes. The fruits of the restored gospel are evident in the lives of its faithful members. Woo! Preach it! You know, that's the strength of it. Now, there was, I was just saying that, and I asked Sarah, she wasn't going to mention it too. Both Lori and Jana have talked on the first three parts. There is a two, for those who don't know, there is a two-paragraph conclusion that's also calling for dialogue across differences. Let's not let these things be reasons that we can't work together. And of course, on what was it? Remedy the many of the moral and family issues saved by society. So read all the code that you want into that language and things like this. So I'm certainly not against that too. But that's basically the document that basically missed. So if this was only part of the statement, the things that we focus on today were only part of the statement, I would be fine. I see that an external audience is something we have to anticipate. This is a question that comes up. We addressed it. I'm always fine when we reach across the aisle. But well, as I say, what I miss here is the chance to preach Christ. To talk of lives that are transformed, of souls who, because of encounters with Christ, live in a new way. This last Christmas season, the lyric from O Holy Night was just a key meditation for me, which simply says, "And the soul felt its worth till he appeared." You know? This thing, and again, there's going to be some folks here who Christian language bothers them, and I'm comfortable using Christian language, but what I'm for sure, whether it's through Christianity, whether you think of Christ, and whether you need to tie it to Son of God, or whether you need to do anything that, I can testify of a life transformed by some message. In my case, it came through Christianity that says this is who God is, and this is how much God loves you, and maybe you can be a person of worth. maybe you can kind of rise above this ego mind and this desire to look good and all the different things that complicate us. You know, I think that our Book of Mormon has the wonderful language of the natural man. I wish it would just be the natural person here, but it's this false identification that we have to put off. And we have to take this ego mind, this false person, and take it to the cross. It has to be crucified. That is the message of the gospel. That is what's happened in my own life through these metaphors. But I want to testify to that. And so what would it be? Here we declare to the world that we're Christian. Why isn't the world, you know, why do we care? Why don't we just let them notice that these people live out of a strong paradigm, a strong identification with Spirit? You know, I love Mosiah 4. Guess what? When you're centered right, you will not suffer the beggar to put up his petition in vain. It's not like this is a goal. It's not like this is a commandment. It simply says this will flow from being centered. Paul says these are the fruits of the Spirit. These are not the goals that you set to be more loving, to be more patient, to be more kind, all those things. These are the fruits of the Spirit. And we have a document here that doesn't preach it, doesn't teach it, doesn't do anything except defend it on grounds that other people have set. And I'm sad about it. And I'm depressed about it. But here's where I can draw strength. This is at least something I can do. You know, I can't sit around and wait for better press conferences or for better messaging or something like that. But in my spot, in my sphere, I can preach this Christ. I can preach transformed lives. I can preach our beauty, our depth, our richness. And I don't need to wait to see the change happen. Up at the Seattle Symposium, I spoke, and I've been really moved by Parker Palmer's model lately of, if you're going to be an activist, if you're going to, you know, get involved in these things, you cannot use results as the way to measure anything. Instead, he says it's faithfulness is the one that he proposes. And what he says as a faithful person, because you're going to burn out if you keep saying, until this happens, I'll keep working, or you get depressed because those things don't happen. You can't control it. The only thing you can control is your stuff. So for him, faithfulness is faithfulness to your gifts, faithfulness to your truths, faithfulness to the things you know. And when you can say those and when you can act in those, you have the renewal. You have the resources for an ever-renewing thing. You can be the activist. You can be the voice for 30, 40 years in, you know, the voice crying in the wilderness or something like that. You can do it when you're faithful to what you know, to what's strong within you. And so in my depression, in my sadness today, I can only preach that these were gifts that my life story, my teachers, somehow or other, Christ and this message of I can be more got to me. I'm going to try to share that. Missed opportunity. I understand PR. I understand all that stuff. But at least with you in my sphere at this moment, that's what I'm going to offer. Can I read you the rest of the lyrics?
Yes.
Listen to this. Listen to this song in this context. And Sisters of the Sun, you could do little sun, S-O-N. So just listen to this. Rock me on the water, sister, will you soothe my fevered brow? Rock me on the water, I'll get down to the sea somehow. Spirit, that place. Oh, people, look around you, the signs are everywhere. You've left it for somebody other than you. You're lost inside your houses, and there's no time to find you now, to be the one to care. Your walls are burning and your towers are turning. I'm going to leave you here and try to get down to the sea somehow. The road is filled with homeless souls, every woman, child, and man, who have no idea where they will go, but they'll help you if they can. Now everybody must have some thought that's going to pull them through somehow. Well, the fires are raging hotter and hotter, but Sisters of the Sun are going to rock me on the water now. Sister, will you soothe my fevered brow? I get down to the sea somehow. Oh, people, look among you. It's there your hope must lie. There's a seabird above you, gliding in one place like Jesus in the sky. We all must do the best we can, and then hang on to that gospel plow. Rock me on the water, rock me on the water. When my life is over, I'm going to stand before the Father, but the Sisters of the Son are going to rock me on the water now. Rock me on the water. Thank you.
I know Dan Weatherspoon is my brother in the gospel. We're both preaching from lyrics today. This is my PowerPoint. Kind of old school. So, are Mormons Christians? Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Asterisk. Insofar as Christian is translated correctly. Yes. Mormons are Christians. And, you know, I think that's kind of, you know, funny and tongue-in-cheek, and I love Mormon puns and that interplay more than anything else on God's green earth. But I also think it's really true. And, I mean, that's what leapt out to me initially was, yes, insofar as Christians or Christianity is translated correctly, then yes, Mormons are absolutely Christians. So the essay addresses the role of Christ in the gospel, right? It tallies the times his name is mentioned, and it does absolutely everything but go all caps lock hashtag, we have the name Jesus Christ in our title, fools. But they would not say that. That's not how the church talks. But if they could, they would. But what they don't say, and the question that I find super interesting, where I think this is the alpha and the omega of the identification of Christians, is the engagement of grace versus works. And we know that Mormons land solidly on the work side of that equation, right? So I think it's proper to take on our Mormons Christians from that framework. So if it is works, then that means Mormons are Christians insofar as they are offering service, insofar as they are doing the work. And I think one of the mistakes, and something that I don't see really engaged in this essay, is thinking about it in terms of identification, in terms of the analysis of the terms and the history. And it doesn't talk about so much what Mormons do. And I think what that leads to is this calcification, this idea that Christian identity is static, that it's a yes or no question, it's super binary, and you either are or you are not. But I think most people agree that there is an opportunity there to engage with the word, and that is a moment by moment. That is a day-by-day engagement. And that, you know, some people find that they have not made that engagement. They have not grappled with that. And where they thought they were, they are actually much farther out from the shore because they've just been going through the acts or the lip service, and that the being in the body of Christ or being an engaged Christian means that there is service involved. So I want to share a couple of stories with you, because everything that I know comes through stories or song lyrics. That is the only way I know how to learn anything, which is why I failed chemistry. There are no good song lyrics about the... there's one good song. I'll tell you later about the periodic table of the elements. But that's it. So my first story has to do with this job that I'm doing now. I'm a faith organizer for the Human Rights Campaign, and they hired me. I wish they had put this into writing, because it would be awesome and I could show it to everybody. But they've genuinely hired me because I speak Mormon fluently. And they have a real hard time finding queer folks who speak Mormon fluently and are not of the Mormon faith. So this was super good news to my partner, my husband Jason, because I'm now able to monetize my interest in Mormonism, and he's more on board now. That makes a lot more sense to him. But, you know, initially they said, you know, we'd like you to talk to Mormons and maybe some evangelicals and some Catholics as well. And now they're saying, no, just stick with the Mormon stuff. Like, that seems to be going well. Weird, but well. So keep doing what you're doing and talking to bishops, talking to, forming these small groups, doing this work in Wyoming. But when I first got the job, I realized that I had really sold myself as like, hey, this is my community, these are my people, this is my tribe. I do speak Mormon fluently. You know, I'm your girl, pay me lots of money. They don't pay me lots of money, but, you know, that was the ask. And then I realized, oh no, my community are intellectual secular Mormons. My community are Mormons who have at least one toe in my pond, right? Like, they don't have a whole foot, but they've got at least a toe in it. And what I've just committed myself to is to go and talk to folks who have no toes, who have no connection to the community that I have immersed myself in. And I thought, I am way, way out of my depth. The people that I need to talk to are the people that, as a moderator on sites, I bounce. Are the people who I say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, like, you're too far gone. Oops, like, I need to go back. Those need to be the people that I can now communicate with. So I called my friend Kate Kelly and said, I need to talk to your dad because he was in leadership, right? You know, he was on that side. He's been on both sides. And I need someone to tell me, how do I talk to those guys? What do I say to them? Do I bake them a casserole? Like, what's the deal? Is there a special, like, is there a handshake? No, too soon. You know, how do I navigate this? And bless his heart, Jim Kelly sat down with me for like 2 hours, and the advice that he gave me was so solid and gets directly to this question, you know, of are Mormons Christian? He said, look, any other job, and you know, maybe even other denomination, when you go to make an ask of someone, when you say, hey, you know, I want you to ante up, I want you to come and help me in this cause that you have very little sympathy towards, the beginning and the end is the same. I'm only asking a small thing of you. This will only take a minute of your time. I'm not asking you to make some dramatic shift. I just need you to give a little bit. And if you can just do that little thing, then we're good. This is all I'm asking of you. Don't do that with Mormons. That's the wrong approach. Mormons commit to being Christ's hands on the earth, and that's serious. That's a 3-hour block. That's a calling. That's say goodbye to your family. That's spend 2 years on a mission. If you want these Mormons to hear you and take this seriously, that there is an epidemic of queer kids killing themselves, there's an epidemic of pain and sadness and family loss around the exclusion of LGBTQ people in the church, don't tell them this will only take a minute. Don't tell them that this is a small thing I'm asking you. Tell them, are you or are you not serious about being Christ's hands on the earth? And if you are, here's where the work is. Come serve. He was right. Jim Kelly knows his stuff. That was a profound story for me. So, I mean, there's my first point. Okay. So we know that to prove up on this, we say we need to serve. But we also know that it's not that simple. I have my idea of what service is. I have my idea of what that looks like. It's not always going to be straightforward. And this might lead us to really simplistic formulations. So as long as any kind of service is proffered, QED, it's Christian. But what if that service is going door to door to tell people, it's super important that you vote for Prop 8. We really need to tear these, you know, marriages apart. Preservation of the family. That doesn't look like service to me. But I understand that to many, it absolutely does. And if that service is LGBTQ advocacy, that looks like service to me, but I understand to many it doesn't. So it's not the simplistic, like, service is offered, you're good. You've done it. So what's the qualification there? Like, and I just want to suggest that discernment, which is not, you know, Jana speaks so beautifully about a faith in its adolescence, and adolescents with their prefrontal cortex, discernment is not really their thing. That's not really the space that adolescence inhabits. But it needs to be, rather than that reliance on, you know, authoritarian, hierarchical, receiving the policy, the procedure. Entering into an experience of discernment, into a space of discernment, means that we may not all come to the same conclusions. But the act of it, the act of stepping into that and asking, you know, where am I meant to be here? Where is the service? It means that we ask, where is the pain? Where is the hurt? And I think for a body who identifies with the message in the gospel of Jesus Christ, you can't escape that's it. That's the message. Where is the hurt? Where is the pain? How am I addressing that? And for me, that's a very simple, there's an ocean of pain around the exclusion of LGBTQ members. So, bing, where's the pain? Bing, it's right there. But that, you know, obviously is going to look very different to different people. So my second story, I really want to get into, like, how it's complicated, how it's easy to say, like, look, you know, we need to serve, this is what service looks like, but I do understand that this is a conversation in its infancy as well. I mean, that's how I certainly feel about my work in Wyoming. Every gosh darn time I find someone in Wyoming who is a strong LGBTQ advocate, who is an active, faithful member of the church, and I'm like, oh, hallelujah, finally. Like, great, I'm going to get hooked into this person's network. This is where I'm going to find this broader group of folks so that we can have this conversation about, you know, really expanding the culture in the church to be more inclusive. And every single time they say, oh, thank goodness, Sarah, will you be my lifeline? I got nobody. I'm isolated here. Will you come and sit in church with me? I sit out in the hallway. Could you come to Sunday school with me? Yes, for sure. But that's not what I'm hoping for. You know, and I keep thinking, isn't this happening anywhere? You know, let's be, you know, fair and say Wyoming has more vehicles registered than people. We're a tiny state, you know. There aren't a lot of people there, and finding LGBTQ advocates, period, isn't the easiest job. But this conversation is in its infancy. You know, there is not a lot of strong networking already happening. It's just getting going. Check back with me in 10 years, and maybe this conversation will look very different. Notice I say 10 years and not, like, 6 months. I'm realistic. So one of the bishops that I meet with, amazing man, just beautiful. He says prayers when we meet. I ask him if he'll say a prayer before we talk, and he asks for humility. He asks that he will be educated, and that the Spirit will attend, and that he will learn how to better serve the people in his ward, under his care. And something amazing, this is a career military, pretty conservative guy, and our fourth or fifth meeting, I said something LGBT, and he stopped me, and he said, isn't there a Q and an A on there too? Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's a Q and A. He's like, and
I read in another place, it's there's an I, too. What's the I, Sarah?
The I is intersex. That's great, Bishop. That is very surprising to me. And he's like, I go home. I Google things. I do my homework. It's like, Bishop, you're amazing. But this is, I wrote to my boss, Sharon, after a really hard meeting with this bishop. And I said, ministry work in Wyoming pro. I can feel my heart expanding and something new working inside me. Con, it robs me of sleep. I had a good meeting with the bishop last night, the fifth or so time we've met. He wanted to know how the world perceived Mormons. Side note, he also said his daughter, who's left the church, who's resigned, is asking him about these meetings that he has with me. And he asked her, he said, what do you think she thinks about me? He's like, and his daughter said, Dad, she probably thinks you're the devil. And then, no, let me talk to your daughter. So he wanted to know how the world perceived Mormons. So I said, strong families, but unkind to the LGBTQ community. I think it was a sincere question, but also an intro to tell me that my side is winning. And it is faithful LDS kids who bear the brunt. They bear the brunt of censure and bullying from a world that accepts new norms and casts aspersions on orthodoxy in all of its forms. I didn't really take on that comment because I know it makes me feel defensive, really defensive. And I'm working on not responding in the moment while I feel that defensive. So we talked more about starting a small group at my house after the holidays, and I emailed him at 4 a.m. I thought this was a good window into where we are in Wyoming, breaching the hard conversations, looking for a little grace, and stumbling along in our imperfections. So here's the email I sent to this bishop. Subject line, our Maginot line. Bishop, I've been up since 3 thinking about what you said about my side winning, and by inference, what that means for LDS kids living the standards. 1, I'm trying to soften my heart to feel the pain that accompanies sending our children out into a hostile world. I want to sit with that for a while because I know it's real, and I know I have some resistance to it. The other point that has me not sleeping is the idea that if we make more room for gay people to feel loved by their ward and heavenly parents, my side will have won. I don't think that's accurate. Not just because it's a win for the ward, too, but because it sets my side and your side up as opposites. And I don't feel as though we are adversaries. I feel as though my side and your side, if that's what they are long-lost siblings. And we've been apart so long we've forgotten our common tongue, no longer remember our shared customs. People expect us to be wary of each other and to reject the unfamiliar. But in my vision, and we all know, I borrowed this from Joanna Brooks's vision, that we sit down at that same table and remember that we're family and we begin the work of relearning our common language. I don't want my side to be the enemy of your side. In my own heathen way, I love the restored gospel and I love the people it creates. Your people have taken me in and loved my children, dressed my wounds and made me vegetarian funeral potatoes, perhaps one of the greatest gifts of all. My Mormon sisters teach me your hymns and squeeze my hand when the beauty and longing for Zion expressed in those hymns makes me cry. We can't be adversaries, Bishop. My world is better with you and your people in it. Thank you for making time for me. It's always a joy to meet and learn from you. I'm going to try to make it on Sunday. All love, Sarah. So that was our complicated way of communicating with one another. And I'd love to say that after that hard conversation and that showing up and being vulnerable for each other, because that was hard for me, I will tell you. We made it work smoothly, and we're on the same side now. But we aren't. We're still having hard conversations. There's still... We have a long way to go. But as a side note that I do want to, I was thinking about not including in this, but I do because I really want to address the news conference on Tuesday.
not this bishop, but another bishop that I meet with, I go to a lot of church. I go to a ridiculous amount of church. And I sit outside a lot of bishops' offices, which gives me some keen insight to what it feels like to be an outsider. You're always sitting outside there, and people walk by you and like, hey, you know, like pitying glances, like she spends a lot of time. She must have some serious sins to repent of. And I kind of want to explain, like, I'm not. Like, quit looking at me like that. But, you know, this other bishop had said, I want to show up. I want to do a fifth Sunday service for LGBTQ kids. I want to talk to the ward council. I want to write an op-ed or talk to the legislature, but I absolutely cannot. I represent the church. If you want me to do that, you need to go to Salt Lake and have them open up that door. And then Monday morning, the press conference came, and I texted this bishop and said, hey, I think you're going to the legislature. I believe that door just opened. I believe they just said, we're in favor of non-discrimination. Guess what? We've got a non-discrimination bill in Wyoming. Show up. They opened the door. He texted back, don't get your hopes up. I don't think it means that. And I said, I'm going to send you some articles. I'm going to send you, you know, some stuff. He read it. We spoke on Wednesday. He's addressing the Wyoming legislature next week. As a sitting Mormon bishop, serious cred, a lot because he played basketball for the University of Wyoming, but also because he's a sitting Mormon bishop and a lawyer and carries a lot of respect. That makes a difference in Wyoming. Sunday he couldn't do it. Wednesday he can. So there was a lot of pain in that press conference. There was a lot of bad there, but we need those votes in Wyoming. Almost a full third of the senators who will vote on that non-discrimination are LDS. And the difference between having a bishop show up and say, because of my faith, I can tell you, and because the church has opened the door to this to say non-discrimination is wrong, I believe we will get those votes. So that's my side note on that. But getting back to service and thinking about, you know, sides and being adversaries and, you know, which side wins. Do we minister to the queer kids? Do we minister to the kids who, you know, this bishop says they come into his office. He says, you know, they come in and they say, I'm being bullied at school. They say, you know, your church, you guys are bigots. You hate gay people. You know, and everything else you've ever heard about, you know, why Mormons are bigots. You know, that's hard for him. That's hard for him to hear. He does, I mean, he feels like his kids are bullied. And, you know, I think we ignore that at our peril. A peril that I'm very prone to. I mean, when I hear it, I just want to be very, very defensive and say, hey, your kids don't commit suicide. Our kids do. Shut it down. Pay attention to where the hurt is. That is not particularly helpful. That is not a very helpful a point of dialogue. So I think we do actually have to lay that down and listen to each other and say, you were experiencing this as pain, and so I need to listen to that. My last story comes from my friend Jolie, who is, name's Jolie Holland, and she's a singer and a songwriter, and she wrote a song called Corrido por Buddy. And a corrido is, particularly on the Mexican border, song for fallen heroes. Usually I think they're in, like, drug cartels or something. But this was a song she wrote for a friend of hers that she lived with on the streets. She was kind of a gutter kid living on the streets in New Orleans and in Austin. And she had a real hard time, you know? It's not as plush as you would think living on the streets in New Orleans. And she didn't know how to navigate it, and so one time she left her friends, and she found a car to sleep in, and she slept in a car. And she said Buddy was the only person who came after her. He was the only one who, like, went and found her car and knocked on the window and said, hey, how are you doing? Can I get you anything? And brought her, you know, a slushy from the 7-Eleven. And Buddy was Mormon, And he went home to Salt Lake under the express spiritual get straight. Literally, get straight, you know. Wear a button-up shirt, no more of this, you know, gay stuff. So he gave it a go. And he was a gay kid, so that didn't work out for him. So he ended up, he started doing heroin, and he overdosed on heroin. Which is not that atypical of a story coming out of gay children in Salt Lake City. And when Jolie wrote a song about him, Corrido Per Buddy, she said he had that bad religion in his blood, the kind that brings you down, and it can never lift you up. And she was talking about Mormonism. And when she told me that story, I thought, that's bloody, you know, that's painful. But the piece that I felt like she was missing from that story is that when Buddy went and found her on the streets, he was doing his home teaching. Like, he was still a good Mormon boy. And, you know, when the world looks at Mormonism and sees these impulses to collapse us into very binary, very gender-specific molds, they miss the beauty, and they miss the creativity, and they miss the service. They miss that Mormon kids are brought up to serve over and over. Yes, you know, Mormon children learn, I am a child of God. But what does a child of God do? A child of God serves. Not on Sundays, not 1 hour a week, every day, over and over. You commit and recommit to those covenants. So, are Mormons Christians? Absolutely. Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox Christians may not agree that Christ went to the Americas. Let's just say they don't. But according to the book of John, Christ transcended death and appeared to his disciples. And what was his message? What did he come back to say? Feed my sheep. So I want to bear my testimony that although the word casserole does not appear anywhere in any of the scriptures, I do believe that that's what he meant. He meant, feed my sheep and feed them casseroles. So when Mormons commit to showing up, bearing casseroles rather than condemnation, apologies rather than apologetics, they not only prove up on their claim to membership in the body of Christ, they enlarge what that means. With works, yes, but also with grace. Because how a dish made with cornflakes and cream of mushroom soup gets transformed into pure love can only be accomplished by copious amounts of pure grace. Thank you.
So that would conclude the speaker portion. As you can see, we are running out of time, but I suspect that the other session is going to be going late as well, since we got a late start. So if you need to step out or whatever, please do. But let's go ahead and have the panelists come up, and let's take a few questions for at least 5 or 10 minutes if we can.
They're out.
Okay. Are there any burning questions? Any in the back?
I have a comment. People can respond to it. I wrote it down.
But, you know, I sat here listening to people talking about whether we're Christians or not. And I can understand why a PR department of the church would care. That's why do we care so much when so many other American religions don't? Maybe it's facile, but I really mean that. If you just put the word traditional in front of Christian, the debate's over. And yet we seem to obsess about these labels. I identify with what Dan was saying. Why do we worry so much about how people define us? You left the word. But why is that? Why do Mormons care so much? I can understand how a few other people who don't like different religions want to argue over who's going to. But, you know, it almost seems silly. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if they want to respond, but it seems silly to me.
Yeah. Don't have the confidence. You know, if you're confident in spirit, you can act well. If they don't have the confidence to of who they are, that's why they care. That's why Jan says you're looking for approval in somebody else's eyes, because you haven't grown up into yourself yet.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but it's... That's right. I mean, but... You know, they're sects of Muslim, they're killing each other because one's true and one's not. And there's sects in Judaism. I mean, in my town, the Sikhs were going at each other with knives over who is the true sect. you know, people say, but I'm telling you, most people out in the world couldn't care less.
Absolutely.
Most people who might want to convert to Mormonism, I'm going to do it because of the lifestyle and the love and all the rest. I don't think they could care less, and yet we seem to spend all this time obsessing over how other people define us as a group. And not even define, categorize, not define, categorize.
Which seems to be kind of part of the human condition, too, I think. We have a lot of self-doubt. In the back, I'm sorry.
You know, to me, it seems like it's kind of a recent thing. I grew up, I was a teenager in the 70s, and I don't ever remember a discussion about our Mormons Christians. We taught how we know better than they do, you know? And so at some point, this transition was made, and now all of a sudden there's this insecurity. But I actually think it's been a good thing. I think we've actually become a more Christian church because of this. We've had to display that we're Christian more. I think the LDS church has actually become more Christ-centered since we became insecure about this, and I think that's a good thing.
That's a good point, too. You were next, and I'll get to you in the back.
For me, somebody coming at it as a never Mormon and raised with a family that was half Southern Baptist and half Pentecostal, they're the drivers of this, right? I mean, if you look at America today, I mean like the last 30 years or so, Roman Catholicism, they're no more worried about whether Mormons especially are Christian than they are about anybody else. They're part of an ecumenical mix. Mainline Protestantism, you know, no. Judaism, no.
They don't believe that any of us are Christians, really.
Right. It's like we're all driven by our people in Pentecostalism and in fundamentalist evangelical. That's where it comes from, and I think it really has to do with the power that those parts of American Christianity have with Mormonism inside America, but the power as agenda setters that they have. I mean, these, I don't know what to do. I mean, I was really moved by what Dan was saying, but I don't think some people are persuadable, right? And I think over time there's reason not to be sad because over time, just as with the lesbian gay stuff, right? It's over time there are going to be a number of persuadables. Over time there will be some aren't, but I mean, I think there's reason to be more cheerful.
Hopeful for the future, exactly.
Right now, I mean, it's hard to stop, and I don't know. I read those essays, and I don't see the paradoxes of the world.
No, I don't. I think you're right there.
And they weren't fully honest either, but they were getting there.
Yeah. The problem is that we're political allies, conservative political allies, and it's uneasy.
The traditional marriage debate is certainly a big part of that equation. Yes. Getting acceptance, exactly. I'm sorry, back here, one more.
And it's nowhere more evident than in Kingdoms of Glory. I mean, that's nothing more obvious. And with that comes in, well, how do we get saved? Oh, not through Christ, but through what we do, through our ordinances. And, I mean, we teach as Mormons, oh, our ordinances are symbolic of Christ. So it's still about Christ, but people often in the church don't see that. But it still comes back to this idea of Mormon exceptionalism, that we think that we can become like God. And for people that are Christian, that's like just horrible to them because God's omniscient and omnipresent and not someone talk about the omnipresent theory. And they do that because we don't teach God, Father, and the Spirit as one, but as two separate beings. So people get really confused and they have no idea how to contextualize that with their language within the context of our language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. It was a wonderful discussion. I appreciate it.